He was the wittiest, the prettiest, the strongest, the bravest, and of course, the greatest, as he told us himself. Muhammad Ali was one of the 20th century's most fantastic figures and arguably the most famous man on the planet. But he has never been the subject of a complete unauthorized biography. Jonathan Eig, the journalist, has now changed that. Hailed by Ken Burns as one of America's master storytellers, he radically reshapes our understanding of the complicated man who was Muhammad Ali, delivering a biography of an American icon. The name of the book is Ali, A Life, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Jonathan Eig to the roundtable this morning. Jonathan, thank you very much for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
At what point did you decide you wanted to write such a comprehensive biography of Muhammad Ali?
Well, I had the idea about 5 years ago. I mean, I was a huge Ali fan growing up and just thought he was more like a superhero than a sports hero. And, you know, I got a little older and he got a little older and I thought, man, you know, there hasn't been a complete biography of Ali yet. Nobody's really done the whole story, cradle to grave, and it seemed like the right time to do it. 50 years had gone by since he became champ, since he protested Vietnam, and there were still tons and tons of people around who knew him, ex-wives and family members and friends. So I just decided to take it on and ended up interviewing about 250 people, spent four and a half years on the project.
And during the process, he passes away. So that has to then, people are I assume, coming out of the woodwork to talk and discuss the legacy of this man.
Yeah, that's right. I was well into the book before he passed away, and I'd met him, and I had hoped that I might get to read the book to him. His wife had suggested that he loved hearing about himself, and I was hoping to read the book to him, but then he passed away, and I didn't get a chance to do that. But yeah, once he passed away, then all kinds of other stories about him emerged. People began, you know, sharing all of their encounters with Ali, and that really was, you know, opened up new opportunities for me.
One of the things that you get in the book, and I don't know why, maybe it isn't really a surprise, but at least it was something that to the degree that you write about it, he was a very complex man. He's a complex figure, and there are a lot of layers to figure out, aren't there?
Yeah, he was much more complicated than I expected. You know, when you have these heroes in your childhood, it's often dangerous to find out what they were really like. And I still loved Ali. He's still unbelievably charming and graceful and good to people. But he was also a terrible husband. He mistreated his wives and didn't pay much attention to his children. And he was terrible with his money. He took way too much punishment. He just allowed himself, even when he could see that these punches were doing damage, when he knew it, he kept fighting, you know, for too many years. So there were some disappointments along the way.
When you look at the life, as you say, the Ali, A Life, at what point did he start to know that his athleticism was going to be his career, that this is who he was going to ultimately become?
He figured that out very early, in part because he was dyslexic and he struggled in school and he was desperate for attention. He loved being the center of attention and, you know, became the class clown because he couldn't really please his teachers with his schoolwork. And then at age 12, he discovered boxing and he said right away, this is it. This is going to be my rocket to the stars. I'm going to be famous. I'm going to be the greatest of all time. He started bragging about it even when he was 12, 13 years old.
When you started to dig into this, how willing was the family to talk? How willing were his friends to speak about him? We talk about how upon his death that more people spoke, but there was also a lot of loyalty to him, correct?
That's right. It took some work. It took some persistence and some convincing to get a lot of folks to come on board. Some of these guys, you know, like Don King and Louis Farrakhan, who I interviewed, they don't give a lot of interviews, and when they do, they tend to repeat the same stories. But I worked very hard over the course of, you know, several years to convince them that this was a serious book and that I really wanted to get the story right. I didn't want to do just another love fest that turns him into a saint. I wanted to really get at the truth of what this man's life was like and that I needed their help. So in the end, I got almost everybody to cooperate.
He was a humble guy, though. Despite the showmanship, he was a humble guy.
Yeah, in a strange way. I mean, he went around calling himself the greatest all the time. It's so people kind of raise their eyebrows when I say how he was humble. But for all of his wealth and fame, and for all the women that he enjoyed and everything else, he never really acted like he was better than anybody else, and he remained really good to his people. You know, he'd meet somebody on the street and really take interest in their lives and invite them to come for dinner and sometimes remain friends for years. I think he had a remarkable sense of humility.
You talk a lot in the book about the cognitive damage as a result of his boxing career. And is that something that you walked into that you knew you were going to look at so comprehensively, or once you realized that, or did you see that there was a real story here and that kind of developed over time?
It surprised me a little bit to see how bad it was, because I knew he had Parkinson's, but I didn't know whether it was caused by boxing or whether it was partially caused by boxing. But, you know, it became clear the more I researched this that the damage was directly due to boxing, and it began to show itself very early. His fight doctor, Ferdy Pacheco, said that he saw signs of permanent brain damage as early as 1971. And, you know, that's mid-career. Ali went on to fight another decade after that. So if he was already showing signs of brain damage in 71, I wondered what it would be like, you know, to try to figure out how bad it got. And I worked with statisticians. We counted every punch that Ali was struck with over the course of his career. And I worked with speech scientists, and we looked at how those punches were affecting his speaking ability, which is often a good indication of your cognitive health. And it was devastating to see the results.
You do point out that Ali himself expressed worry at that time, in the early 70s, that he was suffering some kind of damage as a result. You also point out, I mean, as you just said, you looked at the punches, but more than 200,000 times this guy was punched in the head.
Yeah, that's right. Devastating, really. You know, if you count all of his punches from his amateur career, his sparring sessions, his pro fights, it was about 200,000. And the crazy thing is that late in his career, he would actually encourage people to hit him. Even in his sparring sessions, he would just sit up against the ropes and urge his sparring partners to hit him and hit him and hit him. And he wouldn't even bother to protect himself because he believed that he could build up resistance to those punches, like you can build up calluses. He just thought that if he learned to take more punches, he would be unbeatable, that nobody could ever knock him out. And that was a sad choice for him.
Talk a little bit about, obviously, a large part of his story, and there have been books written just on this subject, and that is his political activism and his change, his conversion to the Nation of Islam. At what point did that start to become a major part of his life? And as you say, something that he was often conflicted by.
You know, it was very complicated. When he was a young man, and he was always concerned with issues of race. His father was always talking about the fact that black people were never going to get a fair chance in this country. And when he became a boxer and discovered the Nation of Islam, he found that he had a voice, that people would pay attention to what he was going to say on these issues in ways that may have surprised him. And he joined the Nation of Islam, and it gave him an operating philosophy. It gave him a set of rules to live by and some principles to rule his life. And that's what led him to his refusal to fight in Vietnam. You know, I think if he hadn't been a member of the Nation of Islam, it would have been a very different story, because the Nation of Islam really became a huge influence. And as a result of that, he becomes hugely unpopular. He's one of the most unpopular people in America in the 1960s because his politics is radical. He's way, way out there. He's too radical for Martin Luther King. Martin Luther King says Ali's a fool and he should keep his mouth shut and stick to boxing. So it was very complicated. And I think it's important to remember that, because right now we think of Ali as this saint, but he was really reviled in this country for many years.
You say that, and yes, that is absolutely true, although it didn't seem to... What impact did it have on his career? Because when he would fight, people would still show up.
Yeah, it was actually good for his career in a way, because people wanted to see him get his brains bashed in. And then in the 70s, when he stopped talking all that politics, he became beloved because he was just this affable, genial, hilarious guy. But so it was very interesting to watch that evolution.
Did Howard Cosell have much to do with that evolution?
Oh yeah, Cosell was an important part of it. They had this great relationship, this great sort of almost like a vaudeville act. Ali realized that Cosell kind of warmed up his image, that they could clown around together. And Cosell was one of the first people to really acknowledge that Ali had a right to change his name and have whatever religion he pleased. And they were a really good team.
And it worked to the advantage of both men, really.
Absolutely. It helped Cosell's career because he had access to the biggest star in the sports world. And it helped Ali's career because people saw that he was a nice guy for all of his outrageous rhetoric.
We watched him, and I think this is what one of the saddest parts of the book is that really his heyday, if you will, was much, much shorter than his very slow decline over a number of decades.
Yeah, that's right. It was, you know, he had this very strange third act. You know, he loses his last two fights, and then he kind of disappears. We don't hear much from him in the 80s and in the early 90s. Because he's not happy with the way he looks on TV. He can't really speak very well. And he's not the kind of image that people want endorsing soft drinks and things because he just doesn't look healthy. And then when he lights the Olympic torch in 96, he gets this final act where he becomes this, you know, American hero again. And we all just want to embrace him and you know, all is forgiven, really.
That Olympic moment is really something, but it's also... It was incredible to see, and everyone was talking about it, but it was also very, very sad.
It was terribly sad. You know, he's up there, and he's holding the torch, and his hands are shaking, and he can barely get the thing done. It looks like he's going to set himself on fire. And I think that's, in some ways, troubling, that that's what it takes to make Ali loved by America, that we need to see him weak. Because, you know, we should appreciate him for when he was strong, for when he was loud, for when he was obnoxious, for when he stood up for his beliefs. That's what really made him great. It's not right that we should only embrace our heroes when they're silent.
One of the points that you make in the book, and I think it's an interesting one, is that at the point where he probably should have stopped, and even though he himself is realizing that he is having cognitive issues, he keeps going. And part of the reason is because of money. He's blown through millions and millions of dollars, and quite frankly, he needs the cash.
Yeah, you know, after he beat George Foreman in 1974, everybody was urging him to quit. He was the champ again. He'd beaten the toughest man on earth. He was 32 years old, which is certainly past your prime for boxing, but he couldn't quit. He couldn't resist the easy money. That, you know, he said, they want to pay me $3 million to fight Joe Bugner? Come on, that guy's not even worth getting in the ring to spar with. So he couldn't resist, and the fact is he had blown through most of his millions by then, and he had alimony to pay and child support, and he still needed the cash, and unfortunately, you know, he paid a price for that.
When you look at what you... all the people that you talk to and ultimately what you come out in this portrait of Ali, we talk about some of the surprises, but in the end, what do you think surprises readers as to how this man lived his life and the legacy that he has?
I think people will really be surprised at the fact that he remained kind of innocent, you know, despite all the fame and the wealth. You know, he never became jaded at all. I think, you know, be surprised at just how badly he treated some of the women in his life. But I also think that you'll be surprised at how, in the end, he manages to remain so charming. And that was it for me, that, you know, he remained a hero because he never sold out his beliefs.
The name of the book is Ali, A Life, and the book is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Jonathan Eig, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Again, the name of the book is Ali, A Life. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.